Welcome back to the Curtis Research Audio Archive. Today, we're embarking on a really compelling exploration. We're going to be peeling back the layers of the rich and often misunderstood history of the Yazidi people. Our specific mission today isn't really to walk through general Yazidi beliefs. We know many of you are already quite knowledgeable on that front. Instead, we're going to meticulously trace their historical journey, where they came from, the external forces that have profoundly shaped them, and how their identity has continuously evolved over many, many centuries. It's a story of remarkable resilience, you know, adaptation and deep cultural roots that, as you'll see, stretches further back than many might realize.
And to truly grasp this sprawling historical development, we're drawing from an incredibly rich and, well, diverse tapestry of source material. We're not just looking at one type of document, you see. We're synthesizing insights from rigorous scholarly research, the raw, invaluable data collected in field notes, you know, directly from communities, and crucially, the living narratives preserved in oral traditions. This multifaceted approach is just vital because it allows for a much more nuanced, more authentic understanding of Yazidi historical development than any single perspective could possibly provide. The inherent challenge, of course, is connecting some of these ancient traditions, elements that have been preserved in texts or oral memory for, 15 to 18 centuries, with contemporary lore. It's like trying to bridge a massive historical chasm, really, to see how these ideas have transformed, adapted, and endured across such significant time gaps. It reveals a fascinating process of continuity and change.
Okay, so let's unpack this then, beginning with the very genesis of Yazidism in the medieval period. If you conjure an image of the Middle East, our focus narrows to a specific, rugged, and historically significant area, the Kurdish Mountains. Precisely northeast of Mosul, which itself is built near the ancient ruins of Nineveh. This isn't just a picturesque landscape, it's the very cradle, you could say, of the Yazidi religion. And at its heart lies the sacred valley of Lalish. It's nestled about 60 kilometers northeast of Mosul, squarely within the Shikan region. This area acts as a crucial transition zone, sort of bridging the imposing mountain chains of southern Kurdistan with the vast, sprawling Mosul plain. It was here, in this unique geographical and cultural crucible, that Yazidism, as an organized religious community with a distinct sense of identity, truly began to blossom.
Indeed. And the academic consensus, it firmly points to a pivotal historical moment. The arrival of the renowned 12th century Sufi mystic, Sheikh Adi bin Musafir. He journeyed all the way from the Biekeh Valley in Lebanon, quite a trip back then, and established his Aladawiyah Sufi order right there in Lalish. Now, this wasn't merely the founding of a spiritual center. It marked the genesis, the real beginning of the Yazidis as an organized religious community. They were consciously developing a profound sense of their own distinct identity from that point. What's truly fascinating, I think, is how deeply the Sufi origin remains embedded in Yazidism even today, centuries later. Despite undergoing profound metamorphoses and, you know, acquiring entirely new significances over time, Yazidism retains a social structure that is explicitly modeled on a Sufi brotherhood. Its rich mythology is just packed, densely populated with revered Sufi figures, and its religious language is still infused with a complex array of Sufi imagery and terminology. This isn't just some historical footnote, it's a living legacy.
That's not just a historical footnote, is it? It feels much more fundamental. The real insight here seems to be how a spiritual movement, Sufism, provided the very blueprint for an entire community's social fabric and religious identity. It really set Yazidism apart from the mainstream right from its earliest days. It highlights how spiritual innovation can literally forge a people, give them structure. And what's truly remarkable is that this early form of Yazidism didn't just stay confined to Lalish. From its mountain heartland, it rapidly expanded northward, traversing the formidable eastern Taurus mountain range, reaching deep into southeastern Anatolia, which is modern-day Turkey. It also spread westward, moving across northern Mesopotamia and extending all the way to the fertile Aleppo region in northern Syria.
Mm-hmm. And we even have records. Take the 16th century Chronicle of the Kurds, the Sheriffnama, which was written by Sheriff al-Dimitlisi, a monumental and crucial historical chronicle, really. It's essentially the first comprehensive history of the Kurds, so it's invaluable for understanding this period. This chronicle reports that seven of the most powerful Kurdish tribes of that era identified as Yazidis. Seven major tribes. And for a brief yet remarkable period in the 14th century, Yazidism actually became the official religion of the Principality of Yazidi. That's modern Sizr in southeast Turkey. So this demonstrates a significant, though perhaps brief, period of considerable political and religious prominence for the Yazidi.
Okay, so it spread widely and even had political influence for a time. The natural question that arises then is, why? Why was Sufism, and specifically Sheikh Adi's Al-Adawiyya order, so favorably received by the local Kurdish tribes in this particularly diverse and, well, dynamic region?
That's a great question. And one major reason, it seems, lies in the crucial socio-economic role that these Sufi brotherhoods played. In the ethnically and religiously varied landscape of northern Iraq, these brotherhoods, like Al-Adawiyya, served as veritable central points of reference for the often isolated rural populations. They were far more than just spiritual centers, you see. They became vital hubs. They facilitated crucial economic exchange between nomadic pastoralist communities and established agricultural communities. They were indispensable for daily life and trade.
So a practical, almost networking function then.
Exactly. But beyond these practical considerations, Sufism's unique spiritual emphasis also made it highly appealing. Unlike more rigid, dogmatic approaches to religion, Sufism highlighted the experiential, emotional side of religion rather than the question of dogma. And this particular characteristic, this flexibility, created an environment where it was far easier for non-Islamic local thoughts, whether originating from ancient Iranian traditions, Mesopotamian beliefs, or other indigenous practices, to be absorbed and integrated, absorbed into what was originally a Muslim belief system. This fluid process of absorption and syncretism was absolutely crucial to the very formation and the unique identity of Yazidism as we understand it today. It allowed for a blend of existing traditions with the newly arrived Sufi teachings, creating something distinct and enduring.
Right. So we've traced their internal development and early expansion, a sort of blending process.
Yeah.
But as with any group, how they were seen by others profoundly shaped their destiny. And here's where we encounter a particularly persistent and damaging accusation that would follow them through the centuries.
Yes, the devil worshiper label. Early Islamic sources, as far back as a 14th century mufti, mentioned that Yazidis would kill anyone found cursing Satan. Now, for Yazidis, this was a deeply spiritual injunction rooted in their reverence for Tawusi Melek, the peacock angel. They believe he shouldn't be spoken ill of, that his name shouldn't even be uttered in certain contexts because of his sanctity. But Muslims often interpreted this very differently.
Negatively, presumably.
Very negatively. They often viewed it as an indication that Yazidis actually worshipped the devil. This perception solidified over time, gaining traction in the wider region. It wasn't just a minor misunderstanding.
And this interpretation seems to have stuck.
Oh, absolutely. By 1671, we have reports from the head of Carmelite and Franciscan missions in Aleppo. He's despairing of achieving conversions, stating there was little chance of achieving anything with the devil-worshipping Yazidis. That's explicit labeling right there. It shows how ingrained the accusation had become among outsiders. Then, in 1674, Michel Favre published his influential book, Specchio, and he went a step further. He directly equated the Yazidi peacock angel, Tawusi Melek, with the devil. This wasn't just some isolated academic theory. It reflected a commonly accepted accusation among non-Yazidis in the region. And European travelers readily absorbed it from them and just echoed it in their writings. This narrative of devil worship became a routine fixture in later Western traveler accounts. And tragically, they often took it at face value without deeper investigation.
Which must have had devastating consequences.
Immense. The key takeaway here is the devastating power of external narratives. This mislabeling wasn't just an academic error. It directly fueled centuries of persecution and military conflict. It shows how a single harmful accusation can shape a community's entire historical experience and lead to, well, immense suffering.
And you mentioned this coincided with increased persecution. Mm-hmm. Especially in the 19th century.
Yes, the 19th century in particular saw a dramatic increase in persecution and military conflicts against them. It wasn't just religious dogma fueling this, though that played a huge part. It was a potent mix of political, economic, and social factors that made the Yazidis a convenient target. For instance, the weakening Ottoman Empire, struggling to assert central control over its far-flung provinces. They often viewed the Yazidis as an insubordinate, tax-evading population, resistant to Ottoman authority, which was frequently intertwined with Islamic law.
So seen as troublemakers, essentially.
Yep, precisely. And the Ottoman authorities launched numerous punitive expeditions against Yazidi communities, particularly in the Sinjar region and the Sheikhan area. These weren't mere skirmishes. They were often brutal military campaigns aimed at forcing the Yazidis into submission, conversion to Islam, or conscription into the Ottoman army. A particularly grim example comes from the mid-19th century with the massacres orchestrated by Kurdish emirs like Badi Khan Beg. He attacked Yazidi villages, leading to widespread death, forced conversions, displacement, just terrible violence. These weren't isolated incidents either, but rather part of a pattern of systematic oppression.
And the devil worshiper label played into this.
Absolutely. It was expertly leveraged by Ottoman officials and even some neighboring Kurdish and Arab tribes to justify these acts of violence, to dehumanize the Yazidis, making them legitimate targets for plunder and forced assimilation. They were framed as infidels, kafirs, who, you know, deserved their fate. This period drastically reduced the Yazidi population and forced many to migrate or go into hiding. It left an indelible mark on their collective memory.
So, given this backdrop, this really harsh environment of misperceptions and persecution, it's maybe not surprising that early academic attempts to define Yazidi origins were all over the place, varied and contradictory.
Exactly. Some early researchers, like Hammer Purgstall back in 1827, viewed Yazidis through a kind of romanticized lens, saw them as a fascinating relic of a forgotten era. They posited them as descendants of ancient peoples like the Mardi.
The Mardi, who were they?
An ancient Iranian tribe, often depicted quite negatively in classical sources. It shows how early European scholars were already looking for exotic or maybe pagan origins, something different. Other scholars like Layard, Badger, Jackson, they suggested Zoroastrian roots, sometimes blending these ancient origins with Sabaean, Christian, or Muslim elements, reflecting the syncretic nature researchers were grappling to understand.
But then a different view emerged.
Yes, a contrasting and ultimately more dominant branch of research emerged with Sufi's 1885 identification. He identified the Yazidi Sheikh Adi with the 12th century Sufi saint, Sheikh Adi bin Musafir. This increasingly led to the view of Yazidism as a heretical form of Islam, rather than a distinct ancient religion. And this perspective, unfortunately, became dominant throughout much of the 20th century. Scholars like M. Goudy and R. Lescott championed this idea, connecting Yazidis to an exaggerated veneration for the Umayyads, specifically Yazid bin Umayyad, and rather dismissively labeling their religion as demonstrating unbelievable slowness of mind.
Wow, that's harsh.
It is. It highlights how academic lenses at times mirrored existing biases and contributed to a narrative that denied Yazidism its own unique religious identity, instead just trying to pigeonhole it as a deviant branch of Islam.
This era also saw profound internal dynamics shaping Yazidi tradition, right?
Mm.
Especially regarding oral versus written texts.
Yes, absolutely. Historically, like all oral traditions, Yazidi oral lore featured many different versions of the same myths and stories. Researchers of the past observed this fluidity, this variety in their narratives. But then came a significant development in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the publication of Yazidi sacred texts, specifically the Black Book, Mashaf Rash, and the Book of Revelation, Kitab Silwe. This act ushered in a completely new phenomenon where people began to insist on the written version as the sole correct and authentic one. The written word, in this context, acquired the nature and reputation of a holy scripture, and any divergences found in other oral versions were suddenly dismissed as wrong or mistaken.
So a shift towards fixed scripture. Why do you think that happened?
Well, it was a monumental shift, centralizing the religious narrative in a way that hadn't existed before. One could speculate that a powerful, perhaps subconscious motivation for this shift was a desire to directly refute a common and deeply relevant Muslim accusation against Yazidis, namely, that they lacked written scriptures and were therefore considered kafirs or unbelievers. This accusation was so ingrained in Kurdish culture that even local Christians spoke about Yazidism's oral nature negatively, equating it with a lack of true religious legitimacy. So, the drive for written scriptures became a powerful act of self-validation, maybe even a strategic move for religious recognition in a hostile environment, an attempt to counter centuries of negative external perceptions.
Okay, building on this idea of deep historical roots and the dynamic evolution of their faith, you mentioned the research aimed to show how Yazidis incorporated a general substrate of late antique motifs. What did that mean exactly?
Right. Think of it like this. Yazidism, as it was gradually forming from a Sufi brotherhood into a separate religion, drew from a deep well of shared cultural building blocks. These late antique motifs were common ideas or symbols just floating around the region. You'd find them in Jewish, Christian, Gnostic, even Manichaean texts. They were just part of the everyday spiritual language, accessible to everyone, part of a common cultural substratum. Not unique, isolated concepts.
So like shared cultural DNA, almost.
In a way, yes. These motifs, known to us from a wide array of literary sources, likely infiltrated popular religion. They became an integral part of the religious oral tradition of the region because of the constant interaction between literary and oral traditions, between high and low culture. It's incredibly challenging to pinpoint exact origins for any single motif, precisely because late antique Syria and Mesopotamia were veritable melting pots of religious syncretism. Various Gnostic groups, different forms of Christianity, diverse strands of Judaism, they all coexisted and constantly influenced each other, creating this rich, intermingled tapestry of ideas. This constant mingling makes it difficult to trace the precise lineage of any single concept, but it clearly demonstrates the region's historical fluidity of religious thought.
And this is where the historical role of oral tradition becomes really important, right? Preserving and transforming these motifs.
Absolutely. Oral tradition functions quite distinctly from literate tradition. Written texts aim for fixed consistency, usually. But oral traditions have this remarkable ability to retain very old elements over centuries, almost like cultural fossils, while simultaneously absorbing new data and narratives from other traditions. Think about it. Elements of Zoroastrian cosmogony survived in texts like the Iradiant, and even pre-Zoroastrian Western Iranian substratum ideas can be found in Yazidi and Alihaq oral traditions, even after centuries of Islamic dominance.
So it preserves and adapts.
Exactly. This isn't just about ancient preservation. Literacy, even at the margins of a literate culture, can play a dynamic role in this borrowing process. We've seen countless examples in African, Oceanian, and American communities where literate cultures, particularly Islam and Christianity, actively influenced and reshaped oral traditions. It's a constant dynamic feedback loop. New ideas flow into older structures, and older ideas find new expressions.
So connecting this back to specific movements, which late antique groups might have left a mark on Yazidism's historical development?
Well, we can see potential connections. For instance, dualistic movements like Gnosticism and Manichaeism, which posited this fundamental conflict between good and evil, light and darkness, they survived well into Islamic times, and they seriously influenced various Gulat movements.
Gulat, remind us what that means.
Right. Gulat movements are groups whose beliefs were considered wildly heterodox or exaggerated by mainstream Islam, often deifying religious figures or holding radically different interpretations of divine truth. Groups like the Ismailis and Qarmatis, who themselves branched off significantly from central Islamic thought. There's even an argument made by Cyril Glasse that prominent Sufi figures like Bayezid Bastami and Mansura Halaj were in fact crypto-Manichaeans secretly maintaining connections with other Manichaeans.
Wow, so direct, deep, intellectual, and spiritual currents flowing between these seemingly distinct traditions. What about other groups in the region?
Absolutely. Then you have groups like the Nuseris, also known as Alawis, an extreme Shia sect who venerate Ali bin Talib as a supreme god. They are believed to have been strongly influenced by early Christian and late antique Gnosticism. They practice taqiyya, that's religious dissimulation, basically the strategic concealment of one's beliefs in times of persecution, and teach the periodic manifestations of divinity and metempsychosis, the transmigration of souls. This shows clear parallels in their historical development with other persecuted groups who often needed to conceal aspects of their beliefs.
And northern Iraq itself, the Yazidi heartland, seems packed with these kinds of groups.
It really is. It offers a bewildering number of these heterodox groups, the Mandaeans, Alevis, Shabak, Sarli, and Bajalan. It paints a picture of northern Iraq as a truly vibrant, almost chaotic melting pot of beliefs. It's amazing how many distinct yet interconnected faiths managed to coexist and influence each other over centuries.
So what are the common threads between these groups and the Yazidis?
Well, many of them share common historical features. A belief in the repeated manifestation of God in human form, the concept of reincarnation, hereditary spiritual hierarchies that are reminiscent of Sufi orders, and distinct religious obligations that diverge significantly from mainstream Islam. This paints a vivid picture of a historically rich and incredibly diverse religious landscape, where ideas frequently intermingled, flowed, and fused before, during, and after the rise of Islam, shaping communities like the Yazidis in profound ways. These circulating ideas provided a rich toolkit, you might say, for groups forming their own unique identities, drawing on shared symbols and concepts, but reinterpreting them through their own distinct theological lenses.
That's a lot of intense history to absorb, isn't it? Perhaps a moment to reflect on that complexity, especially now that I hear a familiar, comforting sound approaching. Ah, oh, perfect timing. Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady's here. Luz Bosch Hannah. This smells wonderful today, doesn't it?
Let's see. Slight pause. Today, it has a good balance. Not too bitter, not too sweet. Perfect, just how I like it. Sometimes it can be a bit strong and needs more sugar, but this batch is excellent.
Couldn't agree more. A little bit of this warmth is exactly what we need to continue our journey through Yazidi history. That chai definitely hits the spot. And as we feel recharged, let's turn our attention to how these internal developments and historical influences continue to manifest in Yazidi mythology. We can see these deep historical roots embedded within their foundational stories. Take the Adam myth, for example. It has a truly unique Yazidi interpretation. In their narrative, Adam's expulsion from paradise isn't seen as a punishment for a transgression instigated by, say, an evil figure like the devil. Instead, it's portrayed as part of a deliberate divine plan, initiated by the peacock angel, Tawusi Melek, acting directly at God's command.
Right, and there's that striking detail Yazidis often add. Adam needed to relieve himself. And because he couldn't soil paradise with such an unclean act, the peacock angel, in an act of divine mercy and foresight, caught hold of him and placed him outside paradise, initiating the creation of mankind on earth. This inverted interpretation is a powerful example of how Yazidi tradition reworks universal narratives through its own theological lens. Shifting the role of the tempter to one of a divine agent carrying out God's will, it's a profound reorientation of a story central to Abrahamic faiths.
A complete reframing. And this reinterpretation extends to concepts like the kirk, the garment of faith. You mentioned it's more than just clothing.
Oh, much more. In Yazidi tradition, the kirk holds multiple intricate symbolic levels. It can be seen as the clothing and companion of God at creation, a cosmic garment that existed before the world. It's also an angelic garment, or even the clothing worn by Adam in paradise, embodying purity and divine connection. Furthermore, it represents the garment of incarnated angels or heroes, the cause, symbolizing the divine gnosis or profound religious instruction they impart to humanity. And on a more personal level, it is the garment of the truly faithful, specifically the Fikrs, who are an order of religious ascetics. For them, it represents a state of religious enlightenment and spiritual commitment. Ultimately, it is an eschatological reward for those who strive for spiritual perfection, a mark of their journey towards divine union. This kirk is often described as luminous black, paradoxical and profound, and is intrinsically connected to divine gnosis and spiritual well-being.
And this idea of a special garment connects to other traditions.
Yes. It finds striking parallels in late antiquity. The garment of light, or robe of glory, was a pervasive motif. We see this in Jewish and Christian traditions, in Gnosticism, Mandaean texts, and even Syriac Christianity's elaborate theology of clothing, where garments often symbolize spiritual transformation or divine investiture.
So it's a very ancient and widespread symbolic idea.
Mm-hmm.
But are there key differences that make the Yazidi kirke distinct from, say, a Sufi kirke, which is also a garment of initiation?
That's an excellent point. And yes, there are crucial distinctions despite superficial similarities. While the Sufi kirke is often a physical garment of initiation and spiritual lineage, the Yazidi kirke typically didn't cover Adam in paradise in the same way. It wasn't accompanied by a crown, and its symbolic meaning wasn't seen as a direct source of revelation in the way a prophet's word might be. Nor did it function as an eschatological symbol in the exact same manner the Yazidi kirke does. These subtle but significant differences highlight how Yazidism absorbed common motifs, but profoundly rearticulated them to fit its own unique theological framework.
Okay, let's explore two other powerful mythological themes that highlight these deep historical roots. The motif of another seed and this concept of the trimorphic manifestation. Tell us about the other seed idea first.
Right. In the Yazidi myth of Sheda Binjer, he is miraculously born from a divine sir, often defined as a divine light or power placed directly in Adam's forehead. This miraculous birth makes Yazidis a special race, distinct from the direct lineage of Adam and Eve. There's an alternative variant where Shehid is born directly from Adam's seed without Eve. What's fascinating here is how this connects to Gnostic notions, where figures like Seth were believed to be born from another seed, a divine spark from a spiritual world, not the created material world. Leading to the concept of a special spiritual race of Seth, it suggests a direct uncorrupted lineage separate from the rest of humanity, giving the Yazidis a unique spiritual identity.
A unique origin story. And the trimorphic manifestation. What's that about?
Then we have the myth surrounding Prophet Ismail's birth and the concept of trimorphy. In the Yazidi story, three merchants encounter Ismail, but each sees him differently. One perceives him as an old man, another as a young man, and the third as a baby. This multiform appearance leads to their recognition of his divine power, his keramet, that miraculous spiritual power, and ultimately to their conversion. So this idea of Trimorphi seeing a divine figure in multiple forms simultaneously wasn't unique to the Yazidis.
Where else do we see it?
It appears in Nusairi texts about Ali, showing his transcendent nature, that he's not bound by singular form or time. We also see it in very early Christian stories, like the Acts of Peter, where Peter himself sometimes appears differently to different people, or in the Abgar legend, even the Armenian infancy gospel, depicting a multifaceted manifestation of divinity. And even ancient Greek philosophical concepts like Elion, representing timeless eternity, and Chronoi, representing linear time, played with this idea of multifaceted existence, a single essence manifesting in various temporal states. This means this motif was a deeply ingrained part of the spiritual language of the entire region, a common symbol that could be adapted and reinterpreted by different communities to convey the transcendent nature of their revered figures.
As we've seen, these historical and mythological links brilliantly illustrate the ongoing process of synthesis and reinterpretation within Yazidi oral tradition. It's a tradition that has constantly adapted, absorbed, and enriched its narratives, drawing from the incredibly diverse religious milieus of the wider region. It's a testament to the dynamic nature of their faith, constantly evolving while holding on to its core. Now, let's fast forward quite a bit into the 20th and 21st centuries, a period of immense change and new challenges for the Yazidis, particularly in Syria. After the collapse of the Ottoman Empire following World War I and the subsequent rise of new nation-states, while the world order in the Middle East certainly did not favor Kurds or Yazidis, they simply lacked a strong, unified political voice to advocate for their interests on the international stage. Instead, new masters took control of their territories, and with them came a new breed of administrator scholars. These individuals, often reflecting the colonialist approach, frequently re-emphasized the Islamic origins of the Yazidi community.
Yes, trying to fit them into a familiar box.
Exactly. Their analyses, perhaps unwittingly, led to problematic views of Yazidism, sometimes describing it as an un-Islamic Islamic faith, or even a belief system incomprehensible to its own believers. A truly dismissive and biased perspective that just ignored the richness of their evolving identity and traditions.
And during the French Mandate period, which followed World War I and lasted until Syria's independence, Syrian Yazidi communities navigated a particularly complex political and social landscape. The French authorities implemented a sectarian-driven settlement policy. New villages or land allocations were often given to homogeneous religious or ethnic groups. For example, Salamiya was designated for Ismailis, Jabal Daruz for Druze, and significantly, the Wadi al-Jara, a small dry riverbed, became the exclusive home to six Yazidi villages. This policy, while perhaps intending to maintain order by separating groups, also inadvertently reinforced existing divisions and sometimes confined minorities to specific, often less desirable geographical areas.
And there were conflicts, too.
Oh, yes. A notable incident occurred near Terzbesbi in 1923. Yazidi scouts, specifically Abbas Amoka, Ahmad al-Kaut, and Ali Bati, played a crucial role. They assisted Kurdish tribes in securing a victory against a small French garrison. This led to a temporary flight for the tribal leaders and their Yazidi allies, though they eventually received a French pardon in 1926. Demographically, Henri Lamans in 1907 estimated around 3,000 Yazidis in the Kurda area. Later, an unofficial 1937 census listed 1,082 in Jebel Akrad, 87 in Hasak, and 797 in Kamishli. By 1945, Zakaria estimated around 3,500 Yazidis, and a French mandate census indicated that Yazidis comprised approximately 10% of the 200,000 Kurdish population in the region. So a significant, albeit concentrated presence.
Okay, a noticeable presence, but within a fragmented and controlled system. Then came independence in 1946. What changed for Yazidis in Syria then?
Well, following Syria's independence and the French withdrawal, the Yazidis faced an entirely new set of challenges in a rapidly changing political landscape. The new republic was characterized by an unstable political system, frequent military coups, intense infighting among various factions. Concurrently, there was a surging wave of Arab nationalism. Political rights that minority groups had managed to gain during the mandate period were gradually eroded. For instance, while Christians, Alawites, and Druzes retained some representation in parliament, Kurdish and Jewish representatives were completely excluded.
Excluded entirely.
Completely. Yeah. This underscores the deep political instability and resentments among various ethnic, religious, and political factions. A cohesive national Syrian identity failed to emerge. Instead, the national discourse became increasingly dominated by Arab nationalists, often with underlying sectarian tones. This was further intensified by the three-year union with Egypt, which enforced strict political centralization and an aggressive policy of Arabization across Syria. This impacted minorities like the Yazidis profoundly, attempting to erase their distinct cultural and linguistic heritage.
So, a very difficult period politically. Were there key figures who stood out for the Yazidi community then?
Yes. Within this tumultuous period, several key figures and events stand out in contemporary Syrian Yazidi history, illustrating their struggles and resilience. Shimo Issa, for example. He was a founding member of the Kurdish Democratic Party in Syria, established in 1957. During the three-year union with Egypt, when many Kurdish activists faced intense persecution, Shimo went into hiding. His family endured significant harassment, their home searched, relatives interrogated. After receiving a pardon, he continued his work with the Kurdish party despite being banned from his teaching profession by the Syrian government, a common tactic to marginalize perceived political dissidents. He notably participated in the Tel Katun revolt, a significant uprising in the Jazeera region where over 70 Yazidi farmers were arrested. He organized crucial support for the prisoners and their families.
He sounds incredibly brave and committed.
He was. Shimo Issa later became a vocal advocate for limiting dowry amounts, a significant social issue that burdened Yazidi families and prevented many young Yazidis from marrying due to poverty. Reflecting his commitment to his community's practical well-being, he supported the PUK in Iraq and later the PKK-led uprising in Turkey, demonstrating a pan-Kurdish solidarity. Shimo Issa passed away in 2006, remembered for his powerful and inclusive motto, "I will finish the mission Tulsi Melek has tasked me to do and help other people regardless of their religion." His life really encapsulates the struggle for both Yazidi and Kurdish rights.
A unifying figure, battling against both internal economic hardship and external political pressures. What about more recent events that continue to shape their experience in Syria?
Well, the early 2000s brought further turmoil with the Qamishli events of 2004 and 2005. The Qamishli football massacre in March 2004, which erupted after a football match between local Kurdish and Arab teams escalated into widespread protests and a violent crackdown. Followed by the assassination of Sheikh Mohammed Mashuq Ghaznawi, a prominent Kurdish cleric and outspoken critic of the regime in 2005. This led to an omnipresent secret service presence across the region. Pervasive surveillance pushed political opposition further into the private sphere, making overt activism incredibly dangerous.
And the Arabization policies continued.
Oh, yes. This era was also marked by significant demographic tensions and aggressive Arabization policies by the Syrian government. Arabs in the Jazeera region felt like a minority in their own country due to the large Kurdish population, while Kurds vehemently complained about violent Arabization practices, which they saw as an existential threat to their cultural identity. The government reacted by systematically relocating Arab families to Kurdish lands, building new villages like New Tanuria right next to the existing Kurdish village of Tanuria, effectively creating Arab belts to dilute Kurdish demographics. This also meant Arabizing names on official documents and forcing Kurdish children, including Yazidis, to attend mandatory Islam classes in often hostile school environments where their own religion was ignored or even denigrated, further marginalizing their distinct identity and attempting to erase it from the public sphere.
This brings us to a fascinating and relatively recent aspect of modern Yazidi history, their evolving identity-building process, particularly among Syrian Yazidis. The experience of the diaspora, especially to Germany, seems to have raised entirely new identity questions.
It really did. For the first time in generations, Yazidis living abroad no longer faced the constant threat of persecution. They didn't need to hide their religion, which had historically been an important aspect of their religious understanding and self-preservation, often manifested through that practice of taqiyya. This new freedom allowed for a redefinition of identity. Notably, within the semi-autonomous cantons established in Syria since 2012 amidst the civil war.
And this led to different identity groups forming.
Indeed. We've seen the formation of at least two separate identity groups emerge from this period of reevaluation. Some Armenian Yazidis and some Sinjaris, along with certain villages in the Shaykhana region like Bashika and Bazani, began to claim Arabic roots or explicitly deny an exclusive Kurdish origin. This was partly fueled by internal Iraqi Yazidi political rivalries, particularly between factions associated with the KDP and those with other leanings, and even attempts by Saddam Hussein's former government to deepen these rifts by appointing rival mirs, or religious leaders, in an effort to divide and conquer. In this dynamic and often volatile environment, the Movement for a Democratic Society, or TVDEM, a civil administration and social movement, played a crucial role. Since its establishment in 2012, TVDEM offered protection to Yazidis amidst the chaos of the civil war and actively facilitated meetings to revive customs, forming committees for reconciliation and popular support within the community. This provided a framework for Yazidis to openly explore and assert their identity in a secure, self-administered context.
And the 2014 Sinjar events, the horrific genocide perpetrated by ISIS, had a particularly profound and somewhat unexpected impact on Syrian Yazidi identity, didn't they?
Yeah.
How did that global tragedy reshape their self-perception?
It was a truly seismic event. Prior to 2014, many Syrian Yazidis often looked at their Iraqi counterparts with a sense of, well, envy, if not admiration. They admired the political and cultural achievements made by Iraqi Yazidis after the fall of Saddam's regime reserved seats in both the Iraqi and Kurdish regional parliaments, for instance. These achievements were seen as a model to aspire to for greater autonomy and recognition. However, after the devastating Sinjar massacre, a critical and transformative shift occurred. Syrian Yazidis came to the powerful conclusion that they possessed something equally valuable and unique: their self-administered cantons in Rojava, northern Syria. In these cantons, they actively participated as ministers, military leaders, teachers, council members. Their legal rights and religious identity officially recognized and enshrined in their own constitution.
So a realization of their own strength and structure.
Exactly. And the role of the YPG and PKK fighters, including many Yazidis from Syria, in rescuing Iraqi Yazidis from the Sinjar massacre, effectively reversed the traditional hierarchical order. Suddenly, the Syrian Yazidis, who had previously felt marginalized and looked to Iraq for inspiration, were now in a position to offer military protection and self-administration to their brethren in Iraq. This fundamental shift profoundly reshaped their collective self-perception. Moving from an envied minority to a community with a vital protective and administrative role, demonstrating their own capacity for self-governance and resilience.
As we bring this discussion to a close, we've journeyed through the vibrant tapestry of Yazidi history, from their ancient roots and the profound influence of Sufism, through periods of persistent persecution and external misrepresentation, and into their continuous process of self-definition and adaptation in the face of immense external pressures right up to the present day. It's a story not just of survival, but of dynamic cultural and religious evolution, proving that identity is never static.
And this journey leaves us with a compelling thought, perhaps. When we consider the continuous negotiation of identity and meaning that a community like the Yazidis undertakes through historical pressures, both ancient and modern, constantly adapting, reinterpreting, synthesizing diverse influences, what does it truly mean for any cultural or religious group to claim an authentic or original past? How do collective narratives shape, and how are they shaped by shared experiences of both profound continuity and transformative change? This complex interplay of past and present, tradition and adaptation, is perhaps the most defining characteristic of human history itself. And for the Yazidis, it's a living, ongoing process.